This is Talk Radio, a forum for new thoughts and fresh ideas, a place to learn and an opportunity to express yourself. Get involved with our newsmakers and our newsbreakers of today and tomorrow. Talk Radio invites your participation. Talk Radio is...
Bill Jenkins.
Well, it's Saturday night, and welcome aboard, everyone. For the next 2 hours, we're going to take a flight, you and I, and there is no telling just where we may end up. And we're going to talk about something that flies rather well. The UFO. The unidentified flying object. Is it a part of the reality that we have, or is it a modern-day myth? Well, if you've been with me for the last 5 years, you know that it's, in my mind, not a part of a modern-day myth, but it is a reality of the world that we live in. It's very difficult for some people to realize that that is a part of our reality, but maybe we can help you understand that better tonight, give you some more facts to chew on. With me is Mr. Edwin Slade, and Mr. Slade has quite a record of looking rather deeply into this matter of the UFO. Does it or does it not exist? Ed, you're here. Is there such a thing as a UFO, and are they from other worlds?
Well, the simplest way to believe in UFOs, Bill, is probably to go out and see one for yourself.
That's always the best way.
And I maintain that the world is very highly polarized at this point, because people who've seen them surely believe in them, and people who haven't will never believe in them. So we're not here to convince anybody to change their team tonight. We just like to discuss it, admittedly, from a biased view.
Mm-hmm.
That bias is that, yes, I have seen one UFO in the past, and it was remarkable, and it got me into studying the subject as deeply as I could.
Give us a little bit, Ed, about your background, why we can listen to what you have to say and have some trust in it, that, you know, you're not just somebody who lived out in the desert somewhere and all alone by yourself one day saw a UFO. As, you know, some of my colleagues say, why is it that only people that live out in the desert or they're ignorant or something see UFOs? Why don't people who have great intellect and knowledge see UFOs? And why isn't the government telling us about that? And why don't we find it in the front pages of the Times and all of these wonderful things?
Well, there's a lot of whys in this subject, and I'd hope to address all of them and give you my thoughts on it, which are personal, and I appreciate the opportunity of speaking out on the subject. To go back into my background, I've lectured and taught at the New York University in the Graduate School of Engineering for 5 years, and I taught rocket theory. I've worked in the aerospace industry, and I've helped design Bomach ramjet engines, solid rocket engines, and I'm very deep into propulsion. I was also at Colt Firearms, which gives me a background in weaponry, and been cleared for secret on and off since 1955.
Now, in being cleared for secret, Ed, can I ask you a secret? Did you find some secrets there that you secretly can't tell us anything about?
No comment.
No comment. About the UFO.
But to get into what I'm doing these days, I'm the chairman of the board of Laser Arms Company, which makes a laser device used for targeting weapons, and we sell these to SWAT teams, military, and police forces. And there are some of our units out there protecting the athletes in the Olympics.
Right now?
Yes.
I'm sure glad they're there. They do, unfortunately, have to be used at times. You also appeared before the House of Lords in their investigation of the UFO.
I think that was one of the proudest moments in my life. I was the first invited guest speaker to an ongoing series, which still continues, in Parliament in London, where a special committee was set up to investigate the UFO question. And approximately once a month, they invite someone interested or prominent in the field of UFOs to speak before the House of Lords. And my first appearance was back in November of 79. And at that time, I brought some information to the House of Lords, and we had a very, very interesting meeting. It was supposed to be a one-hour address, and as I recall, we went for 8 hours without a break. My wife was outside waiting for dinner, and I couldn't forget the circumstances, yeah. But there was no way of disengaging.
I think it's interesting that the British Parliament is concerned about are they wearing white hats or black hats? They seem to feel that there are such things as the UFO. In fact, there's been quite a controversy in London about how much money the government over there is putting into UFO research.
Well, the
secretly.
The position of Parliament was that of an open inquiry, and there were no holds barred. It was a very illuminating and exciting forum, which still continues. And the chairman of the group is Lord Clancarty, who himself has written several books in the field of UFOs. And I have never seen such a well-informed, prestigious group of listeners when you realize that among the audience was the head of British intelligence, MI5, and Admiral Hill Norton, who was the promoted to the Lord of the Fleet and was in charge of the entire Argentine operation. Those are pretty eminent people who came to listen to what an invited speaker had to say about UFOs.
But here in the United States, the Congress will not touch the matter. Anytime information comes to them from our government sources concerning the UFO, it's totally censored. You know, our government is saying there's no such thing as a UFO. Here are our documents, and you can't read any of them because they're totally censored.
Well,
which, of course, is a catch-22.
I wouldn't say the Congress is totally unaware of this. There has been one or two good investigations. The Rouse Committee about 15 years ago looked into the matter. In fact, I have a page from their report, which was published through the Bureau of Printing, which classified about 72 shapes of UFOs that had been observed until that time. And that's a very interesting document. The publication was limited, and you're lucky to ever see a copy of it. But there has been some inquiries. But you're right, the general tone of the nation has been to submerge the subject of UFOs to a subject of folly, and it really hasn't...
Quackery and cultism.
Well, yes, that's been the general overview. But to people who are serious researchers and go out and do their own investigating in the field and have their own information, it's a very serious subject.
Well, before we take a little break here, would you agree that UFOs indeed are real?
I would agree that they're real. And as I say, Gallup polls have shown that approximately half the population agrees that they're real.
Would you agree that the government has been covering up the existence of UFOs and at a very costly price?
Well, if you're asking that question, I have to answer in a way that's fair to both sides. I think the government, when presented with the first UFO flap, had a very hard way to go. And they chose a certain public attitude. And being an eminent nation with a public policy, having chose that attitude, they really never changed it.
To this day?
To this day.
Keep it secret. Keep the folks' heads buried in the sand, and more or less about that. We'll take just a break. I'll be back with Alan Slade just to say this. Edwin Slade, who has been deeply involved for many, many years now in the matter of the UFO, the unidentified flying object. We've heard stories, Ed, that some of those things have crashed and that the government has the remnants of the craft and some of the occupants on board. Is that so?
Well, Bill, you're always good at asking tough questions. And let me say this. I would speculate that the answer to that is probably yes. That there have been published reports of craft that have crashed. There have been published reports of occupants taken and that are still preserved. And as a researcher, I've collected testimony and I've collected affidavits of people who have seen crashed vehicles and occupants, so that I believe that there were crashes, although I have not seen a crash personally.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to unravel the many questions you've already asked, I think it's wise to start somewhere. And when you start somewhere in the subject, you have a choice of starting...
Take any point on the circle, I guess.
You have a point of starting at the time of the Bible or before, or continuing up through the many reports through the Middle Ages, or recently the flaps that occurred during World War II, where pilots saw Foo Fighters in the sky, and taking it on to the real wave of reports that came after the first atom bomb was detonated on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to break the chain of reports and start somewhere, because it would take you 6,000 years to summarize the reports.
Well, just for the fun of it, then, let's start with the earliest known reports.
Oh, well, that's easy.
And bring them up to date.
That's easy. I can go back into antiquity and refer to two sources that are really, really ancient. And both of them contain references to UFOs or flying saucers. By the way, the flying saucer name was given by Ken Arnold when he saw a group of saucer-shaped objects flying over Mount Rainier in 1947, thereabouts.
Yeah.
The earliest references that I've been able to come up with, one is very interesting, is... by Hesiod, the ancient Greek author who wrote the Theogony. And the Theogony is a story of all the Greek gods, about 300 in number, that landed and descended on Mount Olympus in Greece in prehistoric times and founded the Greek nation and the Greek panoply of religion. And Hesiod's book, if it's reread today, is very compelling and very exciting, because Hesiod said that he was a shepherd who could not read or write and was minding his sheep. And the way he got the story of the family relationships of all the gods was that the three muses came to him, and by staring at him and never speaking, they transferred the thought that they had in their minds to his. And he was compelled to write the story, even though he was illiterate and could not write. He was controlled mentally by the three muses, who appeared in white garments that glowed. And with their intelligence, the story was created. And that is his preface to the book. And to this day, of course, any great artist appeals to the muses for success in his artistic endeavor. It traces back to the very first ancient writing.
Isn't it interesting that that very same type of technique of writing was also employed by the writers of the Bible?
The technique has been employed many, many, many times. And only now, by reexamining history, do you find how frequently it occurred. Almost the same story was relayed by the originators of the Mormon religion. When Joseph Smith was at home in bed, a lady in a glowing white robe came into his bedroom and compelled him to write his holy book. The story is a very reoccurring in history.
But it doesn't end with religion, as we were talking at dinner tonight, you and I.
No.
Nikola Tesla also had this very same kind of inspiration, as it were.
Nikola Tesla, who was the Yugoslav scientist who came to America and made it his adopted homeland, was awarded over 200 patents, and most of them were in the area of electricity and magnetism. He is the inventor and father of alternating current, which we all use without giving a thought to Tesla.
Right. The generator, the dynamo. He even invented the electronic signal that we're using at this radio station. Not Marconi, but Tesla.
Yes, Tesla's inventions were legion. I felt it important enough when I studied Tesla to go back to his homeland and went to his university. He graduated University of Graz in Austria. I just took a detour once to visit that place to see a building named after him. to try and get the feeling of Tesla, who was so profound and creative in his inventions, and who made so many great statements that you have to think of him in connection with UFOs, because he predicted a lot of things that UFOs can do now. And that's what makes his science interesting.
And we are just now, beginning to understand the science of Tesla. I'm going to take just a break, and we'll be back with Edwin Slade on Open Mind. We'll surface with Edwin Slade about the UFO tonight. We were looking into the past references of the UFO. It goes back to, well, not only biblical times, but certainly the times of the ancient Sumerians. Even the ancient Chinese talked about it, the ancient civilizations in the Indus Valley. That's certainly a part of their lore. The civilizations of North America is a part of their lore. Even down in the island nations of the South Pacific and Australia, it's a part of their lore. I wonder where they got those wild ideas about strange circular craft flying through the sky.
Well, and to summarize all the ancient history, Bill, and this is a study in itself. I mean, you could spend your entire life researching the scriptures and the ancient references, but to summarize them, Hesiod wrote The Descent of the Gods in his book Theogony to Earth, and all our knowledge of the Greek gods are from that original source. He wrote the book by automatic writing by the intercession of the three muses, and we have that book. It's in our libraries, fortunately. We could refer to it. The reason I got to Tesla was because I was trying to say that Tesla, in his later years when he was up around 80 years old, after he was awarded all the honors and had all the fame a person could ask for, he confessed in a public speech in New York that really none of those inventions were his, but that he simply went to sleep every night with a pencil and paper next to his night table. And when he awoke in the morning, there was the next patent, all drafted, written up correctly, and he had no recollection of writing it, but it was in his handwriting.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, when he was in his 80s and had no fear of censure or public ridicule, he said that he had no evidence, but he always felt that he was a controlled being, controlled by extraterrestrials who were manipulating him. And it's interesting that he said that because he invented the radio-controlled airplane.
Mm-hmm. A radio-controlled boat is what he first started with.
Yes, but he felt he was radio-controlled.
Mm-hmm.
And he admitted he had no evidence. It was just intuition.
The things that he wanted to give mankind, or be the channel to give mankind, were enormous. Unfortunately, he got stopped by Wall Street, J.P. Morgan in particular, who felt that giving energy, for instance, to the world was an insane thing to do. That's something that you make money off of and tax. And there's where his troubles started. And because of the actions of Wall Street against Tesla, his name was even removed from textbooks. And I found it incredible to find a college professor the other day that teaches electronics in college. Never knew who Nikola Tesla was. Thomas Edison, they know all about.
Well, Thomas Edison invented the direct current or transmission mm-hmm. lines in New York, and Nikola Tesla invented the alternating current, and they were competitors. And since they both used transmission wires, you're right, it was taxable and it earned income for the owners. But Tesla claimed he could transmit energy to any place on the earth for free without wires.
Well, he was about ready to do that. He was just going to resonate the earth and let the earth do it. Let's get back to flying saucers after we take a break. Tesla we could go into for hours. We love him and the fact that his science is booming again, unfortunately. It is booming in the terms of awesome weapon systems that make the hydrogen bomb look like a little firecracker. But that is happening. Back with the UFO with Edwin Slade tonight. Where else have we seen evidence of it?
Well, I wanted to summarize the evidence in these two ancient writings because most people have access to these books and they can do their own examination of the history. In Hesiod's book Theogony, there's a very curious chapter. Something that's really gone unnoticed by UFO fans, and I came across it, and it was quite interesting, and I'd like to share it with your audience. Hesiod refers to the place where Zeus lives in the sky. And he says that he lives in a floating city. Now, we've heard the floating city before in Revelations, in the Bible. And in the Bible, it's called the New Jerusalem.
It's also in Genesis, where it landed.
There's some very curious references to it. But in Hesiod, Zeus is reported to live in the sky. Hesiod remarks that if you take a very heavy anvil and you drop it over the side of his city, it will fall down to earth, and after 9 days and nine nights of falling, it will strike the earth. That's a very interesting statement in view of our current modern rocket technology, where we could do that experiment. Anyway, it's a simple calculation to compute the height that Zeus's city is located at. And it's somewhere on the order of 3 million miles.
So there's a city out there 3 million miles away.
Well, Zeus could have been in that city at that time.
Well, have we found that city? I mean, 3 million miles is not far for fine radar and electronic astronomy and all of that sort of thing. Have we ever seen anything like that 3 million miles away?
Categorically, I can say yes.
I thought you might be able to explain that to us.
Well, before I explain it to you, you'll have to explain to me why there's no public discussion of this subject.
We're talking to hundreds of thousands of people about it tonight. I think one of the reasons there's no public discussion of it is quite often these things have already been checked out by government and they don't want you to know anything about it. One of the great thrusts of the government is to keep the sheep's heads buried in the sand concerning the UFO and any scientific data that might support anything about it.
Well, then I'll keep my discussion to the open literature,
okay,
which is open but concealed. Let's put it that way. Let's say that we're looking for something up there 3 million miles away, and we wonder where it is or what it could be. So you go back to the literature, and you find that in the 1930s, Carl Jansky, an American scientist, constructed a radio transmitter on a frequency band of about 14.3 megacycles. And he pointed this to various areas of the sky, and lo and behold, he received an echo.
Got the signal back.
Yes. Interestingly enough, the echo was amplified.
Very strange for 1935.
Yes. And he made some private notes of this. And, by the way, he was awarded the Nobel Prize for radio telescopy. He is the father of radio telescopes.
Uh-huh.
This was very curious. The work didn't receive much attention. And after Carl Jansky died, his notebooks mysteriously disappeared. So the subject was very quiet.
Who took the notebooks?
Well, there's been an article written in Astronomy Magazine about 2 years ago or 3 years ago saying that when he died, strange-looking government men in black suits removed his personal effects.
Our government people would remove his government, his effects?
Well,
our CIA or one of those groups?
That's the allegation.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not important because this object in the sky was rediscovered.
Oh, who rediscovered it?
A Scottish astronomer named Lunan, L-U-N-A-N. And he brought it to the attention of the scientific community that if you point your radio telescope towards Cassiopeia and emit 14.3 megacycles, you get an echo that's amplified with about a 26-second delay, which puts that object out at around 3 million miles in the vicinity of the ancient city of Zeus.
Isn't that amazing?
It's curious.
What part of the sky is Cassiopeia?
Cassiopeia.
Cassiopeia.
Mm.
That's near constellation Bootes, or Boots.
Well, I don't have my star chart in front of me, but the coordinates are published.
Mm-hmm.
And it caused enough interest that there was a conference called the Bukharan Conference held in Russia around 1972-73 to address this problem.
The Russians are interested in UFOs.
I think the Russians are interested in science, and yes, they have an active curiosity of something that's observable.
What happened at the conference?
Well, several scientists attended, and there were some publications that followed. And you would say they're open, but they're hidden. Mm. There was an article in the Hungarian Journal of Physics in 76, which claimed that this, in fact, was an ancient object, and it's been called the Lunan object. It really should be called the Jansky object, but it's called the Lunan object. And it's proposed by eminent Hungarian scientists that this is a radio beacon in the sky that has been there certainly since Jansky and probably certainly in the prehistory of the world. And the purpose of this is to transmit signals, amplify them onto the next radio beacon in the sky.
A radio buoy in the sky.
Yes.
3 million miles away.
That's the Hungarian conclusion. And that's the open literature, which is hidden. Because how many people read the Hungarian journals in Hungarian?
Now, this information has been passed on to some of our leading scientific people here.
Absolutely.
Some of our leading institutions that would ordinarily involve themselves in that kind of research right here in the Los Angeles area, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
What do they say?
Very little.
Hmm.
The subject is dismissed quickly, silently, and without much comment.
What does that mean?
Well, it certainly doesn't mean that the intelligence community of the world is stupid. It means the intelligence community is very smart and very aware of what's going on, and I'd like to make that clear to the public. Having dealt with various branches of the community in the past, You have to respect their sources of information and how quickly they respond to events.
But why don't they want the people to know about it? After all, the people are spending billions of dollars on all of this each year.
Yes. Well, there's a conflict, I think. Once you delegate science to someone, it becomes a specialty, and he becomes the high priest of the science, and it's hard to share everything with the congregation, although you depend on the congregation to support the high priest.
Well, maybe the congregation needs to start putting pressure on the high priest to get off of it.
Well, I have personally proposed the Lunan object as a viable mission to examine. It's certainly within the realm of our technology to send at least a remote control satellite or spaceship up to that area, take some pictures and send them back.
Wouldn't hurt anything.
No, but no interest. And I think if you're really intelligent, you have to conclude that no one wants to do that because they've probably done it already.
That could be.
That could be.
It couldn't be the money involved. Not when they can spend $4,785.18 on a screw that we can buy for 3 cents. So Money, of course, is no object.
No, but it's one of those things that slip through the crack in science, and it's something that I think should be discussed. It's one of those enigmas within a paradox that keeps popping up when you examine UFOs and the extraterrestrial implications.
You know, what I want to do, Ed, you know, it's so sad we only have 2 hours to do a show like this, because you and I could sit and talk. We could make a 24-hour show out of this, I think.
My personal record is 4 days and four nights.
4 days and four nights? Well, we could do that, too, I think.
I think so.
I'm going to take a little break here, and when we come back, I want you to touch on some of the salient points that you want to touch, and then we'll turn it over to the audience, who I know I see on the computer is already, they've lined up out there a mile long. But in speaking to the audience right now and talking to Ed Slade, one of the things that we don't want to get into are flying saucer sightings that you may have had. You know, we could fill up a day with that. We know about the sightings. There are hundreds of thousands of them. We feel that it's time to elevate the discussion a little bit further as to what this is all about, what this means, what can be done to get it more in the open, and other questions of that nature that you may have.
you see that the research into antiquity produces very interesting things. And I wanted to mention that people are familiar with the Bible, and there's been many published references to extraterrestrial and UFO events in the Bible. They're well known. But something that's less well known is that along with the Bible, there's a book called the Zohar, which is really a companion book to the Bible. And what the Zohar is an old oral tradition that fills in on those subjects that are not in the Bible. And the origin of this story is supposed to be an oral tradition that Adam handed down to his children, especially to Seth. And this oral tradition was given to Adam, as so the story goes, by the angel Gabriel. And Gabriel came to Adam's rescue when he was ejected from the Garden of Eden. But what's so curious is that on the very first page of the Zohar, it says that the gods came to earth in a chariot. And the word for chariot is Merkaba. And the Merkaba is the UFO. So we have the reference to the Merkaba on the very first page of one of the most ancient traditions handed down from Adam. And we have it in the most ancient Greek book, discussing a flying city or a Merkaba or a city in Hesiod. And the Merkaba, by the way, is the name of the Israeli chariot, the main battle tank that they use today.
Sort of an inside joke with them.
It's an inside joke. The name is still preserved out there in the field in Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought I'd bring that to the attention of some of the audience who probably know some of these pieces and haven't put it all together yet.
Moses wrote of it, too, as we've discussed on many occasions with Drs. Lee and Vivian Gladden here in their book, Heirs of the Gods, which talks about this very same thing,
mm-hmm.
and the city that landed near the present site of Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's very entertaining and cultured to talk of the ancient writings. It gets a little sticky when you talk of the modern writings,
mm-hmm.
and I think you could see why. Tracing the history of the UFO impact into the United States political arena, I think a good place to start is World War II. And I brought with me today a copy of the Los Angeles Times, which was dated in 1942. I can get you the exact date if my eyes were a little stronger. This is a reduced photocopy of the newspaper.
I think that was sometime in the spring of 42, shortly after Pearl Harbor.
Anyway, the headline is, I'll get you the date in a minute. Ah, yes. It was in the Los Angeles Times and then reproduced in the New York Times edition February 26th of 1942. And the headline was Los Angeles Area Raided. And the photo that was included was a whole bunch of flying circles in the sky with searchlights, and shots were fired from anti-aircraft batteries in Los Angeles.
It was the big battle of Los Angeles.
Yes, and of course it was blamed on the Japanese. However, the military report, which I have a copy of, which is a memorandum to the president by George Marshall, General Chief of Staff, said no bombs were dropped, no casualties among our troops, no planes were shot down, and no American Army or Navy planes were in action. But there were shots fired, and searchlights illuminated the circular glowing objects for the residents of Los Angeles to see.
Camouflage zeros to look like flying saucers.
Well, that's the way it started. As a result of that, the press was relatively uncontrolled, and one of the conclusions that George Marshall made from his research was that this was an extraterrestrial threat. This became apparent after Persistent Foo Fighter reports appeared in World War II. And I have a quote that was made by General George Marshall, Chief of Staff.
The music means we have to go. Can you hold the quote until after the news?
Certainly.
And we'll get back to it. Remind you that all of our numbers end in talk. Right, we're back into hour number two tonight of Open Mind. My guest is Edwin Slade. He's an industrialist in Las Vegas. He has spent a lifetime studying the UFO, has appeared before the House of Lords, has on and off again top secret clearance. Some of the things Edwin just won't talk to us about tonight. Wants to confine his remarks to things that are relatively open to maintain his stature. When we left you, Edwin, we were talking about what George C. Marshall had to say about the UFO.
I was just about ready to quote the illustrious comment of General George Marshall, Chief of Staff for the U.S. Forces, and then the Secretary of State. And I was about to quote his controversial statement, and I'm happy to report that in the break that we just had, I received no calls from Washington. no voices on the other end of the line. So I'll continue.
They don't listen.
No, they're listening. They're probably listening to us right now and running our voices through a voice analyzer to see if we have a lie. And that technology is here now. You know.
Oh, yes, I know about that.
Okay. Well, George Marshall said, quote, in 1955, in a press statement to the media, that the United States authorities had, that's past tense, had established the fact that flying saucers were manned visitors from outer space. And these visitors were trying to work out a method of breathing and staying alive in our own atmosphere before landing and establishing contact. Unquote. Now that's a very exciting statement.
That's from George C. Marshall?
That's from General George C. Marshall.
And where did you get that statement?
That was published in the media in 1955. It received national distribution.
Hmm.
Now, when you said before, what's the government's position? Well, in 1955, that was the government's position. And, you know, I tend to agree with George Marshall. I think he's a hell of a nice guy, and I think he shares a lot of the opinions that I have.
He was in a rather elevated position in government.
Yes.
Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, I think, at that time.
Yeah. So he has claimed that the United States authorities had already established the fact that these sources were visitors from outer space. And there was a lot of evidence. Remember, that was after the Washington flaps where they sent up armed military aircraft to intercept UFOs flying over the Capitol. And U.S. pilots engaged them in combat, and they were shot down. There were some celebrated incidences at that time that received a lot of notoriety. And there was a spirit of honesty in the government. And let me tell you where the honesty came from. At that time, the United States had won World War II. We had a feeling of invincibility over those years. We had nuclear weapons. And I think the United States wasn't afraid of anything until the UFOs made their presence known in very, very important ways. And the U.S. realized in those years, in those formative years, that they were dealing with an issue that in which they were really outclassed.
Technological superiority.
Supreme technological superiority. And it was quite obvious to the powers in government and in the military that they were dealing with an opponent who could fly at enormous speeds, who could become visible and invisible, who could do things that no one heretofore could do as a human. However, all the events that took place in those years were repeated from stories in the ancient literature, because anyone who's read the Odyssey by Homer knows that Odysseus was protected by the force field shield of the goddess Athena, who protected him from spears and arrows in battle, and who had glowing robes and could make herself invisible, and Perseus could travel the earth at lightning speed and rescue the damsel in distress, Andromeda, and had all the same technology that the UFOs have today. So after recounting the ancient scriptures, it was clear to most scholars that we were just witnessing technology that had been in the ancient mythology, because it had been seen before on Earth, but very long time ago.
I think General MacArthur in that same period had some very interesting things to say about the threat from the sky.
Well, General MacArthur said a lot of things which history will prove to be true, but it didn't make him very popular at the time, as we all know. But on October 9th, you're right, on October 9th, 1955, he published a statement in the New York Times which said that the nations of the world will have to unite, for the next war will be an interplanetary war, and the nations of the earth must someday make a common front against attack by people from other planets. And that's very heavy. That's very heavy to publish that, sign your name to it, and let everybody know that's your true position. That was General MacArthur's
position. We've had reports that he wanted to wind down the Korean War as soon as possible because the real threat wasn't there, it was elsewhere.
Well, as evident by this statement, mm-hmm. He was aware of the interplanetary threat, and it concerned him. And it's one of those concerns that a supreme commander has, that he is powerless to implement against such superior forces.
We say the word threat. Have we any instances where there was a unprovoked attack, or have the incidences that we know of where violence has ensued been actually the result of having to defend themselves?
Well, in the hundreds of thousands of reports that have been collected, I think you can find an example of almost everything, but in general, there's no overt hostility initiated by the UFO visitors as a first response. It's generally a counterattack based on hostility from an earthly source.
Or what could be taken as a hostile act.
I mean bullets.
Yeah. Bullets and rockets.
Bullets and rockets prompt a retaliation, generally.
For a while, it seems that there was a standing order to try to shoot one down on part of the Air Force.
Well, yes, there was. There was a great desire to capture one of these vehicles, and that's...
Now, if they didn't exist, why was there a standing order to try to capture one?
Well, starting around the middle of the 1950s, it was apparent from these two statements from the Commander-in-Chief and General MacArthur and George Marshall. I mean, it was apparent that there's something up there, and we don't know how to deal with it. And I'm sure in those days that it was a soul-wrenching policy on the part of those individuals who had to take a public posture. Because look at the alternatives. If they say, oh yes, we get these interplanetary visitors from time to time and we're powerless to do anything. I mean, that's probably the silliest statement that a government could make.
Doesn't make do much good for the national psyche.
Right.
Also, I think it would require, the people would all at once be wanting the government to spend their time, effort, and money doing other things other than what they're doing, which would upset a lot of apple carts.
It was very uncomfortable to admit your own weakness publicly, and it was also uncomfortable to have to lie, because here we were, a proud nation on top of the world, and someone had to say, well, if we don't lie, at least we can double talk, which was a compromise.
Not
so
really.
It was very awkward, very awkward. I tell you frankly, I wouldn't want to have been in the seat of government in those years to try to make policy, because there is no policy that's really successful.
Well, of course, now it's a matter of doesn't make any difference, but it seems to me that the most prudent course of action, and maybe it's the 2020 vision of hindsight, would have been to candidly reveal to the American people what was going on and marshal the genius of the American people, which is a great deal, in order to deal with it and what way it had to be dealt with.
Well, that's one approach, and I'd like to comment on that. If that was done and everybody was geared up to study the UFO problem openly, I think there was wise voices in government that said, now, wait a minute. We invented the atom bomb. Next thing we know, our enemies have it, and our power is compromised. So this time, let's not make the same mistake. Why don't we, like, keep this little secret within the club? And let's not tell everybody our inner thinking and our inner research, because then our enemies might beat us to the punch. And I think that's a military consideration, and I think it's valid. So, you see, that's another approach. So then came the decades of ridicule. And, you know, ridicule has its effect. You can ridicule the UFO right out of the scientific literature, and that's exactly what was done.
Well, and you hear respected journalists, for instance, some of them on this radio station, say, if they are real, why is it that nobody ever sees them except little old farmers out in a field somewhere or people with not too much IQ? But that just happens to be a statement not grounded in fact.
You know, this is something I never really mentioned to anybody, but if he wants to see one, there's ways to see one. In my travels, and I travel the world a great deal, believe it or not, I met an uneducated fellow, just a young boy. He was in his 20s. I met him in Europe,